dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who's writing on what's happening in various theaters of this war for the free world has inspired and very much engaged me is Dr. Giulio Meotti. He is the cultural editor for the Italian daily newspaper Il Foglio. He writes for the Gatestone Institute and is a weekly columnist as well for Arutz Sheva in Israel. He is an extraordinary resource, and I'm always appreciative of his time. Giulio, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Well, a recent piece that you've written for Gatestone, I believe, caught my eye because it touched on a subject that I'm personally quite engaged on at the moment, and that is the cause of persecuted Christians around the world. And you wrote about this recent meeting that Pope Francis had with the sheikh who is the grand imam of Al-Azhar University in Cairo in the United Arab Emirates. Tell us a little bit about their seance and specifically this agreement that they arrived at, a document that they signed, and where, among other things, it leaves the church with respect to the persecuted Christians, many of them at the hands of the sheikh's co-religionists, of course.
Well, the meeting was quite spectacular, since it was the first trip of a pope in the Arabic Peninsula, where Mohammed and the Islamic religion was born. And the two, the Pope and the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, signed a document titled Human Fraternity. And the document is very generic. They mention a kind of human universal religion in which they don't talk about Islam, they don't talk about the persecution of Christians, which is every year more dramatic. And they agreed about some sentences of, they say, human fraternity. The problem is that the previous Pope, Pope Benedict, had a very realistic approach about Islam. And in his famous speech in Regensburg, in a German university, for the first time, he made a very direct link between violence in the Islamic world and Islam itself. And he asked the Islamic leaders to condemn the verses in the Quran and the other Islamic texts, which are inciting to violence against non-Muslims, Christians, Jews, atheists, etc., etc. The Pope was lynched. He was attacked, not only in the Islamic world. Christians were killed. Nuns were beaten and killed also in Somalia, in Africa. But he was also attacked in the West by the bien-pensants. This Pope has a very, in my opinion, naive approach about Islam, since Pope Francis always tried to find excuses for the Islamic violence. He says Islam is a religion of peace. There is Islamic violence, but if there is Islamic violence, there is also Christian violence. If there is an Islamic conquest, there are verses in the Gospels about the Christian conquest. And every kind of terror attacks doesn't come from Islamism, political Islam, radical Islam, as you want to call it, but from socio-economical issues. One could say that the Pope is trying to find not endangering the Christians, but this is a very important difference. When the Pope Benedict spoke in Regensburg, it was 2006, Christian violence was present, but not so intensive and dramatic as it has been in the last 5 years during Pope Francis' pontificate. So the question is, what Pope Francis with his policies achieving for the Christian population?
Yeah, it's getting worse. That's unquestionably the case. Whether this is cause and effect, I guess one can argue, but it certainly is not helping things. And I guess, Giulio, one of the issues that I'd be particularly interested in sort of your take on is, to what extent is what may be indeed a naive position or stance or policy approach is perceived as submissive by the, well, I call them Sharia supremacists among the Muslim world, is translating into a sense that it is perfectly fine. Indeed, it is God's will for this sort of persecution, this sort of imposition of Sharia on Muslims and non-Muslims alike to be a redoubled effort. So in other words, the Pope, whatever his naivete may be, is actually greatly compounding the problem by being perceived as submissive and capitulating.
In the next month, at the end of March, the Pope will travel to Morocco. And this is the next major trip in the Islamic world. And the goal of this trip is to boast, as they say, moderate Islam. When is the Pope boasting Christians or Christianity? That's the major question. He is trying everything to boast this so-called moderate Islam, which is a fake definition. And he is, in fact, not only betraying the Christians under persecution, he is also betraying those real moderate Muslims, the dissidents, the reformers, those who came under attack. There are many in the West and also in the Islamic world, like Raif Badawi in Saudi Arabia, who are really trying to challenge Islamic extremism, Islamic radicalism. So the Pope, with this policy of appeasement, is in fact not only betraying, not only undermining the Christians' persecution. This year, we are talking, in 2018, we are talking about 4,000 people who were killed for being Christians all over the world. But he's also undermining the challenge inside the Islamic world to fight against these fundamentalists. So in every country, in Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, last few weeks there have been a major massacre in the Philippines in a cathedral. Wherever you look, you see persecution. So the question is, what is the, not only the Pope, but the Vatican policy in general is trying to achieve? In my opinion, it's achieving nothing. They are just trying to appease, as the crocodile in the Winston Churchill definition, a radical Islam.
If only it were doing nothing. I'm afraid, as you've really put it so well, Giulio Meotti, it is achieving something far worse, and that is the emboldening, the intensification of the Sharia supremacists within the Muslim world, and for that matter, the communist Chinese, and I think others besides who are engaged in this kind of global persecution of Christians. This is a topic to which we will return, I hope, with you soon, Giulio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week about this time, by Diana West, one of our country's great observers and analysts of the intersection of our culture, our history, our national security. She is the author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net, and of course, tune in each week as she describes some of what's happening in our world, the kind of clarity that I find extraordinarily bracing. Diana West, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, the president of the United States is meeting today with his Colombian counterpart, and the topic of their conversation will be Venezuela, primarily, one expects. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about sort of socialism's latest victim there at a moment when there seems to be this unbelievable uptick in enthusiasm for it in our own country. Talk about sort of the Green New Deal, if you will, that the socialists have given the Venezuelan people and what lessons we should draw from it, Dinah.
Yes, well, it's a very strange time because you would think this was cognitive dissonance in action in terms of the object lesson of socialism and communism in Venezuela, essentially the planned economy. People become very confused about terminology. Kind of reminds me of looking at the different schools of Islam, for example, and just missing the point that when it comes to jihad, waging jihad, it doesn't matter what school you're looking at. You're looking at the same basic drive for conquest. Sharia, but also just the institution of jihad is just common among all schools of Islam. And I make that point just to bring in this notion that whether we're talking about progressivism or communism or Alinskyism or socialism, all of these ideologies, these maps of conquest have the same drive to control people, to control the economy is usually the major tool that does become apparent in all of these various ideologies that have this singular drive to control, to destroy liberty and the rights of the individual. Well, we're seeing a resurgence of this very openly, very obnoxiously in this country, as we're also watching just the latest in a string of planned economies creating all manner of misery and hunger and oppression and fear and everything else. In Venezuela, destitution and death as well. In Venezuela, and we're watching our own people, comfortable, well-fed people who are now promulgating the same kind of misery in latest iteration in this Green New Deal, telling us that Venezuela has nothing to do with socialism that they are promoting. Or they're just turning another way and not even looking at Venezuela, which again is only the latest iteration of this crisis, which we've been watching seize countries since 1917.
With devastating effect consistently. And so, Diana, give us a quick introduction to the Green New Deal that the left in America is now advancing with full-throated enthusiasm.
The left, including many presidential candidates emerging on the Democratic side. I mean, this is the tendency would be to look at this as something crackpot, which it is, in the sense that it's absurd. However, it is dangerous because these kinds of crackpot absurd ideas in the hands of Soviets and other organizations dedicated to this conquest, these internal conquests, have created millions and millions of carcasses around the world for the past century. So we can't just dismiss it. But when we look at it, we hear the word green, we see the environmental spin. This is just merely the tipping, the little happy edge, the smiley face to get into your bank account and your home and your school and your life and your soul with another one of these centralized, dictatorial, we're better than you, we have all the control, we will run everything kinds of creeds. And it's intensely dangerous because it is absolutely, utterly an obscenity against our Constitution, which is designed to create a structure whereby the government can never have this kind of unrestrained control. And that is what this Green New Deal is all about. Despite what they may say, they are talking about central planning, a government, a federal government that controls all. The states might as well wipe out their names and just be zip codes. And it goes on and on.
Diana, let me pivot slightly. One of the other things that is now increasingly evident in what I think of as the red-green axis, the hard left, of course, the red, and their counterparts, their allies, their enablers to some extent, on the green side, that is to say, the Islamists. This axis is kind of personified by Ilhan Omar, the new representative from Minnesota. And one of the things that she has really gone very full frontal on is anti-Semitism. And there's been some slight backing and filling since, but what does it tell us about the nature of this red-green axis and more generally the Democratic Party that seems to have embraced it, that anti-Semitism is now evidently mainstream?
Yes. Well, I think, and I would say this about all of these developments up to and including the Green New Deal, these are all strands that have been present in streams inside the on the left for quite some time. So this is nothing new in the sense that Omar or Ocasio-Cortez or any of these people are bringing something new to the table. These have come out of the Socialist Party, the Democratic Socialists of America, and their gigantic caucus in the Democratic Party. It's the Congressional Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus of Democrats inside the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill and has been for years. Their credo embraces so many of these radical aspects that these particular spokesmodels are putting forward that we just need to understand that there is continuity here among the left, but we're seeing it certainly taken to a new stage of openness, of brazenness, of obnoxiousness and danger in some of these new elected representatives, certainly including Omar. It is terrifying, but it is a political realignment that people have to get used to, that the left has this alliance with the what we used to look at in terms of the interests of the world against the United States, against our democratic allies, certainly including Israel. It represents the prominence of Islamic anti-Semitism, which certainly we know that when Omar goes back to her constituencies, they are quite happy and familiar with these strains because so much of this also comes out of Islam itself. So this is really the perfect blending of the red-green axis, which we have seen working to great effect or terrible effect already in parliaments in Europe, where this really has preceded our the developments in our own electoral system. I mean, they are always a bit ahead in these terrible developments. And so we can look to Europe, tragically, and see the effects of these red-green alliances writ large on national scenes. And it's anti-Israel, but it's something deeper than that. It's anti-democratic, it's anti-liberty, it's anti-human rights, and it goes right to the ideologies both of the left, which is collectivist, and Islam, which is also collectivist. So again, this is where you really see their core and why they draw each other. It is that desire to control and in these very cult-like ways.
Yeah. This brings me to one particular arena in which this is playing out in Europe, namely the United Kingdom. Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of Britain, has denounced his successor as Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, for basically anti-Semitism, which has been, as you say, a prime feature of Jeremy Corbyn's career. It's just that now it's not simply, you know, the crank extremist view of a leftist. It's, again, becoming mainstreamed inside the British Labour Party and British politics. So the question that I have is, to what extent is that a function of something that we should also be alive to in this country, namely the kind of, well, if you will, fundamental transformation of the demographics of the British electorate that Tony Blair engineered while in office by importing large numbers of people who didn't embrace British values or you know, the sort of traditions of freedom, and instead are not only quite prone to anti-Semitism, but seek to really bring this sort of Sharia supremacist agenda with them as well. And to what extent, if that's happening there, is it a cautionary tale for us as well?
Yes, well, certainly it is a cautionary tale for us as well, looking at how it has become mainstreamed on their left and is becoming mainstreamed on our left. And I think we need to go back and remember the incredibly difficult and yet brilliant concept to get our hands around that Bat Yore, the historian, brought to us at the very beginning. I consider the very beginning being the period right after 9/11, when she tried to explain to us how Europe itself was reorienting along this red-green axis that she explained as Eurasia. And I think this becomes an object lesson of how the prophet who is discarded is borne out by developments in a very short amount of time, as we have watched the Islamization of various European countries, perhaps led by the changes in the British population, brought on, as you so correctly observed, by Tony Blair himself, as practicing this notion of, quote, multiculturalism, globalism, and the rest of it.
Diana, this is why we love having you on, is your clarity on these issues. As I said, it's so appreciated. I know you'll keep up the good work at dianawest.net, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour. Each week, we take one with Bill Gertz, Inside the Ring. That, of course, is the name for his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. He's also the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon and the author of 7 terrific books, including most recently InfoWars, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you as always. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, Bill, as usual, you are doing extraordinarily important work documenting what is emerging in terms of the threat from communist China. You had a piece today at the Free Beacon about the very, well, I guess, clear warning now coming from the new Pacific Command commander, Admiral Philip Davidson. I'd be interested in sort of a quick précis of how he's characterizing the problem that he now sees from the People's Liberation Army, Navy, among others, forces now being arrayed against us in the Pacific and beyond.
Well, this was a real eye-opening hearing by the Pacific Command commander, Davidson, who, for the first time in my memory, really talked about bolstering American forces in the Pacific to deal with what he described as a massive Chinese military buildup that includes new missiles, warships, aircraft across the board, including cyber and space capabilities. He's recognized this. And in addition to the military buildup, which has been mentioned in the past, he also talked about the ideological component of what China is doing. And he was very specific in talking about Beijing's expansion of its form of what he called communist socialist ideology to use it as a as basically a weapon. So for the first time now, we're seeing the military recognize that it's not just a military threat, but it's also an ideological threat, too, that's posed by Beijing.
Right. And this is a sea change, I think it's fair to say. First of all, the U.S. military has been reluctant to even regard it as a military threat until fairly recently. And, Bill, this is something that you've been concentrating on for years, is the sort of information and influence operations aspect of what the Chinese are up to. And how does that translate, as you see it, into a ramping up of the threat beyond just the physical kinetic kind?
Well, definitely. He talked about both conventional forces by Beijing as well as its nuclear forces, and also what he referred to in the military's calling the gray zone conflict area. That's the areas where China is waging non-kinetic warfare against the United States. And again, that's largely economic. It's using its economic power to coerce others. He talked about the use of debt diplomacy, that is offering low-cost loans. And then when states in the developing world can't pay off the loans, in the case of Sri Lanka, they took over an entire port facility there, which is part of their plan to use that for bases around the world.
And those bases, as Admiral Davidson made clear, are increasingly capable of interdicting the free navigation that under basically American protection has been a given in the Pacific specifically since World War II, but more broadly. And Bill, to the extent that the Admiral is warning that that kind of supplanting of our benign sort of domination of the region with one that is clearly ideologically aligned, as you said, with the communist socialist doctrine, this is, it would seem, a real threat to the nations in the region that we've considered allies and who've looked to us for their protection.
Yes, and he talked specifically about the South China Sea, which is the new flashpoint. He said tensions are still high regarding Taiwan, which has been a longstanding U.S.-China flashpoint. But now he talked very much about the danger in the South China Sea. He said Chinese militarization has included the deployment of advanced anti-ship cruise missiles, as well as advanced air defense missiles and electronic jamming equipment. And he made the point that every day commercial flights are going over the South China Sea, whether it's from Singapore to Korea or from the Philippines to Hawaii. And these are all now threatened by these Chinese missiles. And he was very, very clear on the threat that China's posing. He called it a very pernicious and nefarious influence of China's military deployments in the region.
Yeah. Bill, in your piece in the Washington Free Beacon, and again, our guest is Bill Gertz, the Free Beacon's senior editor, you have a list of 10 or so items from Admiral Davidson's testimony, and one, as you just indicated, that caught my eye is this emplacement in Chinese proximity to Taiwan that would enable it to essentially control the airspace over Taiwan with the S-400. We were talking with Steve Bryan about this anti-missile system, air defense system. But can you give us a sense in particular what that kind of air, you know, umbrella would represent for the defense of Taiwan against a Chinese invasion, should that in fact be in the offing?
It's a very significant defense capability. The Taiwan Strait is 100 miles wide, and these S-400 air defense missiles have a range of 250 miles. So what that means is if, as required under the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, the mainland tries to use force to take Taiwan, the U.S. is obligated to prevent that from happening. We now have air defense missiles and anti-aircraft and anti-missile missiles, which can interdict the rescue force of U.S. forces that would be moving to defend Taiwan 150 miles to the east of that island. So this is, again, a very significant advanced capability that the Chinese have deployed.
And, of course, they've gotten it from the Russians, who have been helping arm the Chinese to the teeth, which is a whole other problem. But, Bill, let me turn finally to a facet of what the Chinese are up to in America that is also very worrying. You've reported recently about a spy who was operating against U.S. military electronics facilities in Florida. Tell us about what we've learned in this sort of context and what it means probably more generally for the security of our homeland.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story, and it has to do with a just on Monday, a federal judge in Key West, Florida, sentenced a Chinese national who is a student. His name is Zhao Chan Li. And he was caught sneaking onto the Naval Air Station at Key West, Florida, a very significant military base. It's the southernmost facility, and he began photographing and taking pictures of the antenna field at the base, which are used for intelligence gathering as well as significant communications. He was caught right away, and an investigation showed that he was linked to the Chinese Public Security Ministry, which is really kind of the political police that are mostly active inside China. And here you have one that was active in spying on a military base. He was sentenced to a year in prison. It's an espionage-related charge, but it comes with a maximum one-year sentence of illegal photographing of a military base. And he basically lied to the FBI about his doings there. They found a police shirt in his hotel room, along with a belt buckle for the Public Security Ministry. So this is not an unprecedented case, but usually what China does is send these police to harass and spy on Chinese dissidents in the United States. So that's what investigators think that he was doing. It was perhaps probably a test mission for him, which he seems to have failed. But it also shows that they're interested in spying on our electronic communications, probably for some type of future electronic warfare, which, again, they've created an entire military service called the Strategic Support Force, which has several components, including cyber and space, as well as electronic warfare.
And Bill, is it still the case, as it has been in the past, that the Chinese are using facilities in Cuba for electronic warfare, certainly collection of signals intelligence from the United States, but conceivably also offensive capabilities against us that would operate from there?
Well, there have been reports that both the Chinese and the Russians have been seeking to reopen the large electronic spying base in Lourdes, Cuba, which is on the north coast, again, close to Key West and in Florida. I know that during the Cold War, that facility was capable of intercepting phone calls from everybody in the southwest United States. So it's definitely a concern there.
Yeah. It's my understanding that they have been, you know, reopening as we speak those facilities. But this is something we'll need to dig into in greater detail, because it's a prime location to operate against Americans, not just the military, but against the private sector and even, you know, individual Americans' communications. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There is so much more to talk with you about. I'm always appreciative of your tours, as I say, inside the ring, as well as the tremendous work you do at the Washington Free Beacon. I commend to all of you once again, iWars, War and Peace in the Information Age. A great read on many of the subjects we touch on with Bill each week. Bill, thank you for your time. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a very great pleasure to have with us a man that I had the privilege of meeting last week. I'd heard a lot about him in recent months, but I had not had the pleasure of actually spending some time with him until we were together on the margins of the National Prayer Breakfast. And his name is Polycarp Gamgba. He is a Nigerian, a man of considerable ability and skills, including that of an architect, as a pastor, as a writer, a poet, a producer, a man who has worked on national transformations in some 20 countries around the world, including 12 in Africa. His own is going through a transformation of extraordinary sensitivity at the moment, with an election looming on Saturday. And I was very anxious to have him speak to our audience about some of its insights into what is at stake in this election season in Nigeria, both for the people there, notably his fellow Christians, but for the people more broadly of both Nigeria and the Lake Chad region, and perhaps quite far beyond. And of course, what our most useful actions could be at this moment. Polycarp, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So this election is on Saturday. It is a choice between two pretty unappealing candidates, as best I can tell. Others have told me that a prime issue really is not so much the outcome of this balloting between the two candidates, one the incumbent, General Bukhari, the other man who has a somewhat checkered history, particularly in terms of corruption. But this is about, in part, the constitution under which the country will be governed. Could you talk us through what's at stake?
What is at stake right now, first and foremost, is that Nigeria is at the precipice of internal disintegration on the basis of a Fulani supremacist agenda, an Islamic agenda. And unfortunately, we also have a very partisan agenda that has divided the country. Never has Nigeria as a nation been as divided as it is today. In the past regime, in the past 4 years, the regime has not been very, very helpful in the killings that have taken place, especially in the middle belt of Nigeria. So today, as we face this election, the country is at this precipice where it's a make or break situation about Nigeria. Nigerians are very, very hurt. And poverty has never been at the level it has been as we have now. And you would remember that a few months ago or weeks ago, Nigeria became the leading nation in the most extreme poverty in the world, overtaking India. So you have a situation of poverty and division and disunity. And right now, the promise of violence seems rather rife in the case of this election, because a lot of things have come to a head.
This is a country that it's, again, extraordinary because it has great natural wealth, notably in terms of oil and gas. And yet poverty is so rampant. And as you've said, the killings that have been taking place there at the hands of primarily these Islamists, Fulani militants, as they've been called, Boko Haram, even people very explicitly associated with the Islamic State or ISIS, who have made no secret, as I understand it, Polycarp, of creating in Nigeria the new caliphate in the wake of the takedown of the last one in the Middle East. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. First of all, it isn't just an Islamist thing. It just has a religious Islamic face. It's fundamentally right now, the Fulani is an ethnic supremacist agenda. The Fulanis emanate from Guinea, where they have never ruled Guinea in the last 60 years or 100 years. They have never been allowed to, even though they are the largest ethnic group there. And there they have been kept away because of the kind of people they have been. They have moved into Nigeria from 14 different nations. And in the last 5 to 10 years, their militants have entered into Nigeria and caused untold death in very gruesomely against the people, particularly Christian communities. And this is what has happened. But they have also used the edge or the button of Islam. Boko Haram is a slightly different agenda. It is basically an Islamic supremacist agenda. So you have these twin agendas that have hit Nigeria very hard. That of the Boko Haram, which is actually basically not more than 10,000 people. But the Fulani herdsmen probably are between 200,000 to 500,000 terrorists that have moved into this nation. And if you look at that within the backdrop of an army of barely 70,000 men, to protect 200 million people, you see a military imbalance that has made very vulnerable the Christian communities of the Middle Belt that have suffered the most, you know, in this whole matter. Yes.
Yeah, the Middle Belt being sort of geographically the center of the country, but the threat certainly seems to be that this same kind of assault that has been operating now in the northern part of the country and doing, as you say, grave damage in the middle belt of late is heading to the south, where those oil and gas fields are principally concentrated. And do you agree with the assessment of people like Tony Noddy that fundamentally we need to see a new constitution in Nigeria, not just a new leader who is going to rule according to it?
Yeah, that is a long way off for now. Talking about a new constitution, first of all, the people that are propagating this destructive agenda are still in power. The focus right now and the most urgent thing to do and important to do is to get this regime out of the place. First of all, for you to understand, the Middle Belt is almost 65 million strong, and it's largely the Christian community that have not bowed to the rule of Islam when Usman Dankwodo came in his barrage over northern Nigeria. Now, the Middle Belt was not conquered. And so now, using both the setup by the British and the present regime, it has been an onslaught that is deliberate invasion, decimation, and occupation. As we speak right now, in Plateau State alone, over 70 communities have been razed to the ground and remained in Fulani and Islamic names, as I speak to you right now. Now, if you go across the entire Middle Belt, you are talking about well over 200 to 600 communities that have been decimated and their names have been changed into Islamic names. And now you are having a full import of over 200,000 militia against a 70,000 Nigerian army. And this is the reason why you notice that it is almost an overrun of the nation. And the government of the day is fully in support and very likely complicit in all of this. This is why it has become a dire need for the global community today to come to the rescue of Nigeria. Because right now there is no counterinsurgency force against this barrage and overrun of the country that is supported, and it's actually, you have a government that is complicit in this that does nothing. The army is not going to come to save the Christian communities. The police will not do that.
Let me ask you very quickly, Polycarp, because we're almost out of time. This election looms. It may be that there is a change in terms of the leadership, but continuity in terms of these problems. What would you be recommending the United States government do at this moment to try to help avoid the implosion of Nigeria, the outward migration of massive numbers of people with grave implications, of course, for both the region, Africa more generally, Europe, and quite possibly here as well?
What I will strongly ask the U.S. and the global community is, first of all, Nigeria needs military help to be able to stem this tide. We have made moves and lots of efforts have been made to request President Trump to appoint a special envoy that will be the eye of the U.S. and the United Nations in this country, because right now it has gone beyond what organizations can do. With a special envoy who will have direct access to the President of the United States.
We have to leave it at that, Polycarp Gbajdas. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again after the election, if you would, with further updates. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.